You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And it being the first hour of our Friday program, it being time for Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie hour, be sure to check out his website over at sanders.senate.gov and his Facebook page. Senator Sanders.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Happy Friday.
You too.
So a lot going on in the Senate and on your plate, I'm guessing.
There is. We are keeping busy. Let me just rattle off some of what went on in the Senate this week. Here's some good news. We often don't have the opportunity to talk about good things happening, but this week the Senate, after months of negotiations, finally passed an extension of long-term unemployment benefits. And I know a lot of people have been calling us up on this show. We finally did it in the Senate. We managed to get five or six Republicans to join us, and we got the 60 votes that we needed. That's the good news. The bad news is that it goes to the House, where the speaker there, John Boehner, the Republican speaker, has not shown much interest in making sure that some 2.5 million American workers who are long-term unemployed and their families get the benefits that they desperately need. So the politics of the situation is now that we've got to put as much pressure as we can on the Republicans in the House and tell them that morally it is unacceptable that we're leaving long-term unemployed people out to drift with no income at all, that economically it is stupid because these people don't have money to spend. It will result in the loss of several hundred thousand jobs in this country. So we've got to work on that. It is a huge issue, and I'm glad that we finally made some progress in the Senate. On the other hand, we did not have success. We did not get Republican support for the issue of pay equity. In the United States today, women earn approximately 77 cents for every dollar that a man earns, and there's no way to justify that. We have made some progress as a nation. We have a long, long way to go. This pay equity legislation would have accelerated progress, brought us closer to the day where women made the same earnings as men, and we're going to continue that fight. But we could not get any Republican support. Again, we had a majority in the Senate. You need 60 votes. We could not get any Republican support. On Thursday, in the House, the Republicans voted to support the Ryan budget, the budget of chairman of the budget committee there, Paul Ryan. And I'll tell you, Tom, when you look at that budget, people really, I think, would not believe what we would be saying about it. They think you're kidding, you're exaggerating, you're being political. But here's the story. We are living in a country today where, as I think most people know, the middle class is disappearing. Poverty is increasing. Millions of people are working for longer hours and lower wages. And we have the most unequal distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth. So at a time when the richest people are becoming much richer, when corporate profits are at an all-time high, when one out of four corporations pays nothing in federal income taxes, what the Ryan budget does is substantially lower taxes for the rich. For the average millionaire will be paying $200,000 a year less in taxes and substantial reduction in corporate taxes. Meanwhile, at a time when working families are struggling to send their kids to college, struggling to deal with health care, struggling to put gas in the car to get to work, they make savage cuts in the programs that working families need. So we're talking about ending Medicare as we know it right now and converting it to a coupon program or voucher program where instead of covering all basic health care needs for seniors, seniors are given a $7,000-$8,000 check and told to go out and get private health insurance. Massive cuts in the Ryan budget to Medicaid. So right now what some of us are trying to do is expand health care opportunities. The Affordable Care Act is now providing health care for 10 million more Americans who did not have health insurance. What they want to do is make massive cuts through the Ryan budget in Medicaid. Families are trying desperately to send their kids to college. Major cuts in the Pell Grant program, probably the major federal program to make college affordable for working families. People right now, people listening to the show, are wondering how they're going to provide, put food on the table for their kids. And their solution is massive, massive cuts in the food stamp program. So, I mean, I just urge people to take a look at the Ryan budget. Go to my website, go to any other website that you want, because I think people think I'm over-exaggerating on this or whatnot. But they are doing precisely what the American people do not want. They are doing precisely what the American people do not need. The American people have been very clear. We have to strengthen the social safety net. No cuts in Medicare. No cuts in Medicaid. They are doing exactly the opposite. The American people have been very clear. At a time when the wealthy are doing phenomenally well, they've got to be paying more in taxes. They cut taxes. So it is, it's an obscene budget, but it does tell you what right-wing extremism is all about. What we did this week also, I'm chairman of a subcommittee on primary health care and aging, and we've been working hard. We had a great hearing on the crisis of primary health care. Some wonderful physicians from all over the country, a guy named Stan Brock came, and he's head of an organization, Tom, that does what you would think would be happening in a third world country. He goes to areas in California and Virginia and all over the country and brings together doctors and dentists who are providing their services free, and they do it out in a field or in a baseball field or in a football stadium or whatever, and people line up. Sometimes they spend the night in the cars in order to get the opportunity to see a doctor or a dentist. And he talked about the crisis in primary health care. We had some doctors there talking about the success we're having in expanding community health centers. Other people talking about the absurd waste of money in the sense that when you do not provide health care to people, they end up in the emergency room. They end up a lot sicker than they otherwise would be. That, in fact, you save money by investing in primary health care, and that's something we're working very hard to do. So those are just a few of the things that took place in the Senate, at least that I was involved in during the last week.
In the meantime, I subscribe to your newsletter and read your website, and I saw that you came across David Koch's 1980 presidential platform.
Well, in all honesty, it was a staffer of mine, a fellow named Warren Gunnels, who does a great job for me. And what Warren discovered, and this was really, really very important, is when we talk about the Koch brothers, and we talk about their right-wing agenda, and we talk about the fact that they are worth $80 billion and are prepared and are spending hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to elect right-wing candidates, what people should understand is the ideas that the Koch brothers are talking about now are not just, you know, ideas that they came up with 6 months ago. These are ideas that they have been talking about, right-wing extremist ideas, for 35 years. David Koch, in 1980, ran as the Libertarians Party vice presidential candidate. And during that election, he propounded, along with his presidential candidate, just right-wing, nutty ideas. They got all of 1% of the vote. The frightening thing is that the right-wing extremist marginal ideas that Koch talked about in 1980 are now mainstream Republican Party ideas today. And that is how far the Republican Party has moved to the right and the influence of Koch brothers' money.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. It's absolutely extraordinary. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls right after this, 15 minutes past the hour in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Senator Sanders' Facebook page and his website over at sanders.senate.gov. And welcome back. Senator, was there anything you wanted to add, or shall we pick up calls?
Let's take the questions.
Okay, great. Walter, watching Free Speech TV in Chicago, Illinois, on the Dish Satellite Network, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Question for Senator Sanders. I know you're very involved with the United States Postal Service, and for some reason, I see a connection between that and the concept of the national bank as they have in North Dakota, because the Postal Service is throughout the country. Why not a national bank by and for the citizens?
Okay, good question, Walter. Let me tell you what I think. You got two separate issues here. We have been deeply involved in saving the post office, preventing the loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs, and making sure that people can go to a post office in rural America, make sure the mail is delivered in a prompt way. And the root cause right now of the Postal Service's financial problems has everything to do with the $5.5 billion that they uniquely and in an unprecedented way are forced to pay for future health retiree benefits. They've had to make 75 years of benefit payment in a 10-year period without having to do that. And no other entity in the government has to do that. No entity in the private sector has to do that. They would this year be making about $1 billion in profit. Okay? So what we are trying to do is get rid of that forced prepayment and get the Postal Service back into strong financial position. And one of the ways you do that is give the Postal Service more flexibility. Now, when you talk about state banking, right now the only state in the union, as far as I understand, that has a state bank is North Dakota. And that bank has worked very, very well from probably the 1920s. I may be wrong on that, but I think it goes back that far. I think I'm a believer in state banks. I'd like to see my state of Vermont move in that direction, and other states as well. And essentially what it means is people are investing in their own state bank. They earn their interest. The state then reinvests that money into their communities, creating jobs in their communities, sensible investment, and so forth. What we are talking about for the Postal Service is not really a state bank. What we are dealing with is another issue. And the issue out there is that millions of low-income people simply cannot get a bank account in a regular bank. So what they do is go to these payday lenders. They get ripped off terribly. They're forced to pay very, very high rates to get their checks cashed or to deal with other financial issues. And what some of us are saying is that among other new services, the Postal Service should be able to go into that aspect of banking. And we think it would make money and it would really help people save money on their financial service needs.
Okay. Just 30 seconds, Bernie, before the break. Other things that the Post Office could do?
Oh, a lot of things the Postal Service can do. Right now, I mean, it's so absurd. This happened to me. I went in during the holiday season having bought a gift for my grandchild, and we couldn't get it packed. They can't wrap it. It's against the law for the Postal Service to wrap a holiday package, a gift. You can't, if you go into the Postal Service and you want 10 copies of a document, they can't do that. You want a hunting license, a fishing license, they can't do that. They can't right now mail wine or beer. So there are a lot of services that they can be providing that currently are against the law.
There you go. Okay. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with more of your questions for Senator Sanders right after this in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, right here on the Tom Hartman Show. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls. And Jennifer, listening in Albuquerque, New Mexico on KABQ, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, thank you, Tom and Senator Sanders, for taking my call. My call has to do with campaign donations and with the new Supreme Court rulings. I'm not sure whether or not the donor disclosure laws are in effect. I seem to recall something about, something trying to be passed in the Congress recently, but failing. But in light of the fact that what they're basically saying is that speech is money and money is speech, doesn't the public have the right to know whose money is speaking?
Oh, Jennifer, you are so right. Of course you're right. And pathetically, that used to be the position of the Republicans. What the Republicans used to say is, well, we really don't need much regulation of campaign spending, but at least the people have got a right to know. We want transparency, but they backed away from that. So you have entities, so-called nonprofits, 501c4s, which can essentially hide the money that folks are spending. But Jennifer, in raising this issue, it's not just disclosure that we need. We really need to go a lot further than that. Let me just be very clear. As Tom has heard me say on many occasions, I worry very much that our country is now rapidly moving away from a democratic society with a strong middle class to an oligarchic form of society where both the economy and the political life of the nation are controlled by a really small number of multi-billionaires. And I think, Jennifer, you probably noticed a couple of weeks ago that in Las Vegas, Nevada, Sheldon Adelson welcomed a number of potential Republican candidates for president to come and chat with him. And you had this obscene event where these guys are coming to Sheldon Adelson, who's worth tens of billions of dollars, and they are explaining to him why they would be a good president, and in a sense asking for his anointment. And if they anoint him, whether it's a Bush, a Jeb Bush, or anybody else, that they will get hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. So if we are serious about retaining democracy in America in a very real sense, which means one person, one vote, and not allowing Sheldon Adelson or the Koch brothers to be able to spend huge amounts of money electing their candidates, we need real campaign finance reform. And that means, among other things, overturning this disastrous Citizens United Supreme Court decision. It means moving to public funding of elections. This McCutcheon decision that came down two weeks ago, what was interesting about it is you had people like Clarence Thomas indicating that he wants to go further. He wants to remove all restrictions on campaign funding. And what that will mean, and that is, I suspect, where the court is moving and where the Republican Party wants to go. And if that happens, it will mean that people like the Koch brothers, who are worth $80 billion, will be able to donate as much money as they want directly, not through independent expenditures, but directly to candidate A, candidate B, candidate C. And this will completely and absolutely disrupt American democracy in the most fundamental way imaginable.
Chris in Fairfax, California, listening on the web stream for AM 760 out of Denver. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning, Senator Sanders. And I have just one question. I understand that there is a bill being proposed on genetically modified organisms that would prevent states from banning their use. Can you tell me whether you're going to oppose that and maybe filibuster that bill, or where we are on that bill?
Well, Chris, as it happens, interesting you asked me that question, because I introduced the bill to do exactly the opposite, to make it very clear that states in the United States of America do have the constitutional right to be able to label genetically modified organisms. As I suspect you know, the labeling of GMOs takes place all over Europe, in countries all over the world. I know that in Vermont, and I suspect in the other 49 states, people very much want to know what is in the food that they're feeding their kids and eating themselves. So I strongly believe in GMO labeling. We introduced the legislation as part of last year's agricultural bill to do that, and I will continue to fight for that.
Victor in Pittsburgh, Missouri, watching us on Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, good afternoon, Senator. Senator Sanders, I wanted to ask a question. I was going to ask a question in reference to the wealthy, but I changed my mind. What I'm concerned about is there a way that you can actually force the corporations to buy only American?
Good.
As far as like the ones like the contractors that say they have to be American corporations, and also make them pay taxes every quarter.
All right, Victor, thanks for the question. I think one of the issues, the economic issues, that concerns the average American a whole lot, concerns me a whole lot, is the fact that when you go shopping, it is harder and harder to buy products made in the United States. And a couple of years ago, I was just doing some shopping, and I went to the gift shop at the Smithsonian Museum of American History. And lo and behold, what I discovered in their gift shop is almost all of their products were made in China, in Nicaragua, in countries all over the world, but not in the United States of America. So we brought those folks in. In fact, I just met with them literally yesterday to see how they're doing in beginning to buy American products and sell American products. And they're making some progress, not fast enough. But what Victor is asking is how we create a situation where once again in this country we are actually producing the products that we consume. And a lot of ways that you can do that, but certainly at the root of it is transforming our trade, unfettered free trade policy, and demand that corporations, instead of running to China and Vietnam, stop producing the products that we need in this country. The variety of ways that we can do that, but certainly dealing with trade policies is at the root of that.
Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie Hour, a national town hall meeting, taking your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Be sure to check out Bernie's Facebook page and his website over at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person, and we dare to... No, I don't think so. It's the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. And, Bernie, you're here?
I am right here.
You are here. Great. Gordon, I'm Spokane, Washington. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders, I wanted to ask if you do decide to run for president, and I hope you do, how would you fund your campaign, and how would you compete against Koch brothers and other big money on the right?
Well, I mean, that is, as I think about it and talk to a whole lot of people about it, that is certainly one of the major issues. Needless to say, Wall Street and corporate America and the Koch brothers are not going to be providing huge sums of money to my campaign, and I have never accepted corporate PACs in my life anyhow. I don't want that money. And that's a real problem. And the way I have done it in the past, running for the Senate from Vermont, is primarily through a whole lot of small campaign contributions. I can't remember right now, but I think in my last campaign, I think the average contribution was all of $40. And we raised, you know, we got tens and tens and tens of thousands of folks making small contributions. So money is, I mean, we're living in an age where to run for president, you'll probably need well over $1 billion. Koch brothers are sitting there, you know, they could write out a check for that tomorrow. And that is really one of the real stumbling blocks, not just for me, but for any serious person running for any significant office. You're going to have to figure out how we take on Adelson and the Koch brothers and the other billionaires. But to answer your question, Gordon, I think what we would have to do is very effectively just get a whole lot of small contributions from a whole large number of people.
Mark in Chico, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
I have a question concerning solar panels. They spend money building nuclear plants and tearing up the environment with coal. If it seems like it would be cheaper, besides the $4 billion that goes to the coal and oil industry, wouldn't it be cheaper to put solar panels on every house in America? And there is a way to store it now, from what I understand. And the other thing I want to say is, besides you running, possibly running for president in 2016, I hope everybody gets out in 2014 and votes. And is there a way to set up a website to help people get IDs with donations? Thank you.
Okay, good. Two good points. Let me talk about your first point first. Mark, I think you make a very, very important point, and that is why I've introduced legislation for 10 million solar rooftops. If we make it clear that we're going to help people put up solar, if we continue to go forward on utility-scale solar, what ends up happening is the price of solar continues to decline. We learn how to install these things at less cost, and we can increase our ability to provide electricity through solar. Your point is very, very well taken. But it's not just solar. We've got to end subsidies to the coal companies, to the oil companies. The idea that you have companies like Exxon Mobil, who in a given year, after making billions in profits, pay nothing in taxes, is, you know, totally absurd. So the goal here, and the scientists have been extremely clear, and they're getting more and more clear. Climate change is real. Climate change is already causing devastating problems for this country and the world in terms of floods, in terms of drought, in terms of forest fires, in terms of the rising of sea levels. Climate change is man-made. But the good news is we have the technology now and the knowledge now to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel into energy efficiency, weatherization, into such sustainable energies as solar. So, you know, Mark, what you're asking me is a very, very important question, and I hope very much that we will be able to move forward aggressively in transforming our energy system. In terms of IDs, I suspect that the Democrats are already doing that, trying to help people register to vote and deal with all the obstacles put in the way by Republican governors. But your idea is also very important in that respect.
You know, just recently, both Presidents Carter and Clinton suggested that President Obama, by executive order, could have photographs put on all Social Security cards, which would instantly provide a federal ID for everybody. So it's just a thought. Cheryl Ann in Santa Monica, watching us on our YouTube channel. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Thanks for taking my call. I'm one of the long-term unemployed that were cut off in December. And I'm just curious, does the president have any power to override John Boehner's intentional and relentless obstruction against presenting this bill to Congress for a vote because of his own personal agenda to approve the Keystone Pipeline and to repeal ACA and the environmental regulations?
Cheryl, I wish the answer was yes, but it's not. But here's the story. What Cheryl is talking about is what I mentioned earlier in the show, that finally, after months and months of negotiations, we did get some Republican support, and we passed an extension of long-term unemployment benefits, 5 months retroactive. It is now in Boehner's court. And what Boehner is doing, first he said, well, it's unwieldy. I don't know how we could possibly do this retroactively, blah, 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 blah. And then the next thing he said, well, you know, maybe if we have a Keystone Pipeline in there, we may consider it, or some, you know, repeal the Affordable Care, whatever it is, total nonsense. The way we beat it, Cheryl, I wish I could tell you there was something magical that the president can do. This is the issue we've been running up against every day of the week, whether it's raising the minimum wage, whether it's pay equity, whether it's creating jobs, whether it's protecting our veterans, whatever the issue may be. What Republicans are doing is obstructing in every which way. Now, the good news, though, is we passed it in the Senate. The good news is that the country is going to be focusing on the House, and these guys have fewer places to run. And already we're beginning to see a number of Republican House members who live in the real world, who know what's going on, to their constituents saying, you know what, we are prepared to vote for what the Senate did. And we've got to keep putting pressure on the House. And I think at the end of the day, we're going to beat Boehner on this. But we have to keep putting political pressure on him. People have got to be calling up their Republican congressmen and congresswomen and making sure that they vote for this legislation. So I know these are tough times, Cheryl, but hang in there, and hopefully we'll get this passed sooner than later.
Paul in South Lyon, Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Senator, you gave another brilliant speech on the Senate floor this week. Some people are blaming the president for deporting illegal aliens because they don't understand how laws are made and enforced. The president isn't a dictator, even though the Republicans keep saying he is. He's already stuck his neck out to stop deporting young illegals, and the Republicans are threatening to impeach him for that. And they're saying they won't pass reform because he won't enforce the law. So who do you think is responsible for the failure of immigration reform being passed?
The evidence is pretty clear. We passed the bill in the Senate, I voted for it. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I think it was the greatest bill in the history of the world. It was not. Had many problems with it, but weighing the pluses and the minuses, I thought the pluses outweighed the minuses. Among other things I managed to get is a very strong bill which would provide job opportunities for young people in this country. Because one of the concerns that I have about immigration reform is that a lot of entry-level workers come from other countries to take jobs that young Americans could use. But having said that, the bill was passed in the United States Senate. It took a lot of work. It is now sitting someplace in the U.S. House of Representatives. And, Paul, I'm not hearing a whole lot of discussion from our colleagues there in the House to do the right thing. Do the right thing for the American economy. Do the right thing for 12 million people who are living in the shadows. So I think in terms of immigration reform, the answer is pretty simple to your question. The Senate passed the bill. The House has not yet taken it up.
Okay. Corey, watching us over at sanders.senate.gov in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I believe our number one national security threat is the NSA spying on Congress and the Supreme Court. It just totally eviscerates any balance of powers between the branches. I'm wondering, Senator, why haven't you done more or anything to stop NSA spying on Congress and the Supreme Court?
Well, Corey, I probably have, you know, maybe not done enough, but I've done as much as anybody else has, and this has been a very, very important issue for me. In fact, we've introduced legislation which would end a lot of what the NSA is currently doing, and it's an issue that I feel very, very strongly about. Unfortunately, Corey, one member of the United States Senate cannot, you know, simply snap his fingers and make everything happen. But what we are seeing now is, I think, more and more concern, A, among the American people, and B, among members of Congress, to deal with the reality that it's not just the NSA, but other intelligence agencies are in significant ways out of control. And that, yes, we want to protect the American people from terrorism, but we don't do it by denigrating the Constitution of the United States.
15 minutes before the hour, Senator Bernie Sanders with us in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders. Be sure to check out his websites at sanders.senate.gov and over on his Facebook page as well.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can drop into our live free chat room over at TomHartman.com as well. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Cliff in Port Townsend, Washington, watching on our Tom Hartman app. Hey, Cliff, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. Under the current Medicare rules, out-of-pocket expenses can be much higher in rural districts than the standard 20% of Medicare-approved payments. And I wondered if this is something that can be fixed by the president's executive order, or is it a fix that Congress needs to make?
I suspect that it's a fix that Congress would have to make. In my view, Cliff, Medicare does a very, very good job, but it needs to be improved. And you've touched on one of the ways it needs to be improved. And there are many other improvements that are needed. What we are dealing with right now is an effort by the Republicans to substantially weaken Medicare. The Ryan budget that I mentioned a moment ago begins the process of converting Medicare from what it is today into a voucher program where people, instead of having access to Medicare, would be given a check to go out to the private insurance companies and get the health care they need for a dozen different reasons. This is a disastrous idea. Other people want to raise the Medicare eligibility age to 67 to 70 years of age or whatever it may be. Other people have ideas that would result in higher out-of-pocket payments for seniors from Medicare. So I think Medicare is a solid program, but we need to make significant improvements in it. And as I think you may know, Cliff, my view is that at the end of the day, what we need in this country is to move toward a national health care program which guarantees health care to all people as a right. And probably we could use Medicare as the foundation for that program. program, making it available to people of all ages, making improvements in it. But at the where we are right now is today we have tens of millions of people with no health insurance, many others with high deductibles, high copayments. The Affordable Care Act has helped somewhat. We've gotten many millions of people into insurance, so that's a good thing, expanding Medicaid. But we need a simple, straightforward, cost-effective health care system guaranteeing health care to all people.
Julian in San Bernardino, California, watched on YouTube. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. We have just a minute to the break, Julian.
Hi, Rudy. Hi, Tom. I was wondering if you think we started focusing on agricultural issues like buying local produce or pushing for organic or non-GMO, it would start a conversation of buying local American products. This is something that we consume. It would create an interest in buying American products if businesses notice that consumers are starting to buy local items.
Well, Julian, I think that's a very good point, and it's clearly already happening. I can tell you that on Vermont, you come in the summertime in Vermont, and in dozens and dozens and dozens of towns throughout the state, virtually every town, you're going to have farmers markets. You have CSAs where people are investing in local farms and getting produce. And you go to restaurants, and restaurants are advertising our products come from local farms. There is, for a variety of reasons, a strong movement toward localism. And I think that's a good thing. I think that is a good thing economically and for many other reasons as well.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us taking your calls. More of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Program, and it's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting, taking your calls. Chris in Seattle, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, it's such an honor to finally get on with you. You are definitely my hero and like one of the last honest members of Congress, and I'm proud to be on.
Thank you, Chris.
So there's this issue going on right now in Nevada. The Bureau of Land Management is basically going toe-to-toe with the Bundy family over their use of grazing on BLM land. And this is really coming to, the forefront. I don't know if you're familiar with the issue. And also the Bureau of Land Management in Nevada has been doing these horse roundups. And I don't know if you're familiar with that issue either, but I'd just like to see if you could touch on both of those and where you stand on them, if you're familiar.
Well, Chris, I got to apologize that I really am not familiar with the Bundy family there and the issues that are going on. So I'll try to brush up on it, but I don't have good answers for you at this moment.
Okay. Robert in Clamato, New Mexico. Do I have that right, Robert, watching Free Speech TV?
Yes, sir. Clamato.
Oh, okay. Great. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you. Senator, concerning the Department of Veteran Affairs,
yeah,
they have just passed along a new rule that in order to collect your benefits, such as travel benefits, that you have to have a bank account to make an electric funds transfer. And I'm already living on disability and don't have that much money, and I just don't think – I think that's discrimination for one thing, and I would be curious to what your thoughts
are. Robert, are you telling me that what they are making you do now is have electronic banking?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. I'm chairman of the Veterans Committee. Let me check into that. And give my office a ring in Washington,
okay,
if you could.
Great.
Okay, we'll try to get you an answer for that.
Great. Eudora in Montpelier, listening on WDEV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Really? I don't want to tell you a sob story. I've been trying to get through to you for all years of want. I have MS, and I have seizures and strokes, and I have 6 more physical problems. Who's going to take... Give me insurance. Would you please tell me?
Okay, Eudora, what I would like you to do is as soon as you hang up the phone now, call up my office, 1-800-339-9834, and we'll see what we can do. Okay?
Great.
Please do that.
Thank you very much. Sal, in Peoria, Arizona, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, first of all, I'd like to commend Senator Sanders for standing up for what's right and for the middle class. I want to talk just a minute about and ask a question in regards related to climate change, but taking a little bit different approach to it. You know, we've got lots of shortages, as you know, in gas and oil and water, food, shrinking farmlands, extinction of the middle class. And I'm wondering, maybe, you know, by addressing these issues, these are only temporary fixes, because what I see as a bigger, more holistic problem is the overpopulation of this planet. And I'm wondering if perhaps that would be a better way to direct our attention, maybe starting with the idea of no tax breaks for kids. I mean, we're at 7.5 billion people right now. Where are we going to go when we go up to 8, 9, 10 billion people and more? I think we have to address that issue.
Well, let me just say this. I mean, I think the answer is, and we're seeing it happen, is countries now providing contraception and better education to women, who will then, for the first time in some cases, make decisions themselves about the number of children they want and feel that they can afford to have. And I think, you know, we're making some progress on that, but we have to keep that going. But in terms of all of these other issues, I thought what you were going to say, which is what I believe gets back to an earlier caller, is that we have got to recognize that we cannot simply live a lifestyle which says more and more and more and more, and that a billion is not enough, that we need $40 billion, that we need $80 billion, that 10 pair of shoes is not enough, that we need 100 pair of shoes. And that, you know, getting back to the call that we heard a little while ago from Julian, I think it was, dealing with the issue of localism and purchasing local, we've got to figure out a way to get satisfaction out of our lives through community, through it being part of something in our community, being knowing the people who are producing things ourselves, enjoying people in our community. And I think clearly one of the problems that you have in a hyper-capitalism is we're being told that it's absolutely imperative to buy, even regardless of whether we need what we're being sold. So I think, you know, that is an environmental issue, it's a social issue, it's a personal issue, but I think it's an issue we should be talking about.
Senator, we have a minute, 10 seconds. Not enough for a call. Your thoughts for the week?
Well, what my thoughts are is I hope everybody, and you can go to my website, sanders.senate.gov, you can go elsewhere, take a hard look at the Ryan budget and try to understand what a budget is about and what it says. When you have a major political party talking about huge tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country and unconscionable cuts in programs on nutrition, education, healthcare, the environment, all of which impact working families. And I hope that people educate themselves on these issues. I hope they get involved politically. I hope they come out and vote. But we have got to stand together against the assault that is now taking place against the working families and the middle class of this country. So those are my thoughts of the day, I guess.
Yeah, and very well done. Senator, thank you so much for being with us today and every day, all these years. It's so appreciated.
Okay, Tom. Well, thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Your ability to be here and be here for the American people. We'll be right back.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here, and anything goes Friday. I want to just start out with a couple of things for my stack for anything goes Friday, and then we'll pick up your calls on whatever you'd like to talk about over the next couple of hours. There's so much going on. The Paul Ryan budget passed the House of Representatives yesterday. Let me just adjust. I'm trying to get my seat figured out here. Okay, the House of Cuts. It's amazing. Drug savings for seniors, not anymore. 4.3 million seniors would have to pay more for prescription drugs if the Paul Ryan budget goes through. Let's see, we have callers on the board from California. They, the 358,000 people in California, seniors would pay more for prescription drugs. From Nevada, you'd have 26,000 more. From Wisconsin, you'd have 75,000 more. Or is that Minnesota? I always mix those up. No, Minnesota's 59,000 more. New York, 315,000 more. You know, it just goes on and on and on. It all adds up to 4.3 million. 1.167 million, 1.1 million people will lose access to job training programs and employment services. 616,000 young people will lose access to Pell Grants that allow them to go to college without ending up with enormous student debt. You know, the Republicans just love the whole student debt thing. I mean, it's all about, you know, making money for the banksters. Over 345,000 low-income families lose access to housing assistance. 200,000 new mothers with children get cut off from programs that help them get healthy food. Ah, you could just eat Twinkies. Right. 170,000 kids lose Head Start. 29,000 teachers lose their jobs. Well, we've always got for-profit schools that'll step in and pick up the slack, right? More than 7 million Americans would lose their health insurance. 3.1 million young adults who are still on their parents' plan would lose their health insurance. All the people who have gained, I think the best estimate right now is around 3.5 million people who have gotten health insurance. The working poor who make more than $3,000 or $4,000 a year and less than $11,000, $12,000, $13,000 a year, who through the Medicaid expansion in the principally democratically controlled states that have taken the Medicaid money, they would lose their insurance. That's the Ryan budget. Bernie pointed out, and he started the last hour, how a member of his staff found David Koch's campaign agenda in 1980 when he was running for vice president of the United States on the Libertarian ticket. And this from Bernie's website. Here are just a few excerpts of the Libertarian Party platform that David Koch ran on in 1980. We urge the repeal of federal campaign finance laws and the immediate abolition of the despotic Federal Election Commission. We favor the abolition of Medicare and Medicaid programs. It's David Koch, or the Libertarian Party, anyway, the platform he was running on. We oppose any compulsory insurance or tax-supported plan to provide health services, including those which finance abortion services. We also favor the deregulation of the medical insurance industry. Deregulation? You have no recourse if your health insurance company screws you. We favor the repeal of the fraudulent, virtually bankrupt, and increasingly oppressive Social Security system. Keep in mind, this was 1980. That was 34 years ago. It's still going fine. takes a kicking and keeps on ticking. Pending that repeal, participation in Social Security should be made voluntary. Right. We propose the abolition of the governmental postal service. The present system, in addition to being inefficient, encourages governmental surveillance of private correspondence. Pending abolition, we call for an end to the monopoly system and for allowing free competition in all aspects of postal service. Well, they sort of got there in 2006 by putting that poison pill in the post office budget that said that they had to prepay the retirement health benefits of people 75 years from now. We oppose, we're reading from the 1980 Libertarian Party platform that David Koch ran on as his when he ran for vice president of the United States. We oppose all personal and corporate income taxation, including capital gains tax. No more taxes for rich people. We support the eventual repeal of all taxation. As an interim measure, all criminal and civil sanctions against tax evasion should be terminated immediately. Oh, interesting. We support repeal of all laws which impede the ability of any person to find employment, such as minimum wage laws. The immediate repeal of all minimum wage laws. We advocate the complete separation of education and state. Government schools lead to the indoctrination of children and interfere with the free choice of individuals. Government ownership, operation, regulation, and subsidy of schools and colleges should be ended. David Koch for vice president. This is the Libertarian Party platform in 1980, the year he ran. We condemn compulsory education laws and we call for the immediate repeal of all such laws. Oh. I'm 8 years old. I don't like school. I guess I don't have to go anymore. Cool. No problem. We'll just take it right back to 1890. We support the repeal of all taxes on the income or property of private schools, whether profit or not profit. Oh, so we get rid of our government schools. We have for-profit schools, and they don't have to pay any taxes. We support the abolition of the Environmental Protection Agency. Would you like some Coke industry smoke with that air? We support the abolition of the Department of Energy. We call for the dissolution of all government agencies concerned with transportation, including the Department of Transportation. We don't need those thinking Eisenhower highway system after all. David Koch got private jets, you know. We demand the return of America's railroad system to private ownership. We call for the privatization of the public roads and the national highway system. Oh, you want to go drive to Grandma's house? Have a lot of quarters for all the toll booths. We specifically oppose laws requiring an individual to buy or use, quote, self-protection, end quote, equipment, such as safety belts, airbags, or crash helmets. Oh, isn't that sweet? Because we'd all like to pay more for the emergency room visits for those idiots who don't wear their seatbelts. We advocate the abolition of the Federal Aviation Administration. Free for all of the skies! I have, you know, I'm a pilot, and I have flown in and out of what are called uncontrolled fields, where everybody uses what's called UNICOM. It's one, I forget the frequency now, 129 point something megahertz, whatever it is. Everybody's on the same frequency, and you basically say, you know, hey, this is Cherokee 4175 Tango, and I'm coming into Carefree, Arizona. You know, is anybody in the neighborhood? And then somebody will say, well, yeah, I'm about 6 miles out to the west. And you're all looking around for each other, right? I almost got in a crash. Actually, that was in the Phoenix airport. That was controlled airspace. Anyhow, we advocate the abolition of the Food and Drug Administration. Yeah, you have no right to know if your drugs are effective or safe or even if they have what in them, you know, what it says on the label. We support an end to all subsidies for childbearing built into our present laws, including all welfare plans and the provision of tax-supported services for children. To hell with poor kids. We oppose all government welfare relief projects and, quote, aid to poor, end quote, programs. All these government programs are privacy invading, paternalistic, demeaning, and inefficient. The proper source of help for such persons is the voluntary efforts of private groups and individuals. I haven't noticed any food kitchens set up by David Cook. Maybe he has. He may well have. I don't know. We call for the privatization of the inland waterways and of the distribution system that brings water to industry, agriculture, and households.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Three more from David Koch. Occupational Safety and Health Act, repeal it, abolish the Consumer Safety Product Safety Commission, and all state usury laws.
I mean, it's really amazing when you think about it. The libertarians want to take us back, not to the time before. The Republicans want to take us back to the time before FDR. Libertarians want to take us back to the time before Teddy Roosevelt, before 1901, before the populist revolution. They want to take us back right smack, full bore, full tilt boogie, right back into the Gilded Age. It doesn't get any weirder than that. Harvey in Berkeley. Hey, Harvey, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Well, there's so many forces out there that divide us and make us feel like the other is the enemy. We're alienated from each other. So I created a holiday several years back called National Back Rub Day, the day after taxes. And it falls on April 16th, and I invite the consenting adults to share neck and shoulder rubs in a safe environment. Like I go at my local cafe, we share neck rubs amongst friends, and it's great. It's great. So I'd like to see, and I'd also like to see both the Republicans and the Democrats share neck rubs on April 16th, the day after taxes, National Back Rub Day.
It's a great idea. That's a great idea. What immediately came to mind was George Bush and Angela Merkel. I mean, there are some people for whom that doesn't work, but I think that's sweet, Harvey. That's really sweet. Thank you for the call. Steve in Rotunda, West Florida, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Steve, Anything Goes Friday. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I want to talk about redistricting.
Okay.
The census gives lots of information to the state legislators to restrict redistricting. I don't think they need all that information. I think all they need is how many people are 18 or older on election day and how many live in a certain area.
Mm-hmm.
If they give them names, if they give them gender, if they give them all the other things that the census...
Well, they don't provide names. They provide gender and they provide race, but not names. The Census Bureau doesn't do that.
Why? Is it required?
No. Actually, they're forbidden. The Census Bureau is not a national identity project. It's a national nature of the people project. It's a very different thing from like the INS, you know.
But why would they need all that information? Why wouldn't they just need how many people of eligible voting age live in a district?
Well, originally that's all the census did, and it's built into the Constitution, as you know, that every 10 years there'd be a census so that we can figure out how many members of Congress there should be and where their district should be drawn. But then as federal programs came along that were based on things like how poor people were, you know, how much money we're going to provide to their school systems or how much money we're going to provide in support to, you know, or whether they're agricultural or industrial, whether there are racial disparities that are causing specific problems that could be addressed by federal programs. As each one of these new programs came along, they needed a little bit more data from the Census Bureau to know how to distribute that money. And that's really what has caused the census form to grow from being basically two or three questions to be 30 or 40 questions. And, you can debate the wisdom of it or not, but basically if you wanted to simplify the census, you'd have to kill off a whole lot of federal programs in order to do it, because they depend on census and state programs as well, because they depend on census information. Steve, thanks for the call. We'll be back. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Oh, one other thing I wanted to share with you, Mesoamerica's Mystery Killer. As you know, I'm a member of the AAAS, the American Academy for the Advancement of Sciences. And so I subscribe to, along with your membership, they don't pay me anything to say this, right? I'm just a member. I have been for most of my life. Along with it, you get a copy of their magazine, Science. And every, and it's weekly, and it's fascinating. The 11 April edition is out right now, and I have the digital, I subscribe to the digital, the online version. And there's an article in it titled Mesoamerica's Mystery Killer. Mesoamerica being kind of, you know, middle America. This is Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Panama. And what's happening is there's this explosion of a disease called CKDU, chronic kidney disease of unknown etiology. And it's hitting in southern Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, and Panama. And it is, unlike normal kidney failure, this is hitting young men. It's three times more men than women. It's hitting young people, and it's hitting agricultural workers. And it's starting to reach epidemic proportions. In Costa Rica, for example, in El Salvador, the main reason adults die in El Salvador's hospitals is not old age, it's not lung cancer, it's not heart disease, it's CKDU. It's this chronic kidney disease of unknown etiology. And what happens, basically, is the kidneys just gradually, actually over a relatively rapid period of time, a matter of a year or two, lose their ability to filter poisons out of the blood, and you die. You go into kidney failure. And without a kidney transplant or without dialysis, you're toast. So the question is, what's causing this? Because it's exploding recently. And they've got a couple of hot leads on this. One is, there's two main theories. The first main theory is that these are, you know, farm workers. They're out there working in the heat. It's really, really hot out there. They're out there working in the heat. And this depletes the body of fluids, which makes the kidneys work harder. The kidneys have a tough time when you're dehydrated. So, and repeated dehydration, I'm reading now from this this piece in Science magazine, looking for the authors of the piece, so I can credit them, but I don't see them on the front. They say repeated dehydration disrupts a biochemical pathway leading to excess conversion of glucose to fructose. Now, glucose is your basic simple sugar, and it's the sugar that appears in cane sugar, and a lot of these are cane workers, so they may be chewing on cane. The enzyme fructokinase, which metabolizes fructose, then creates high levels of kidney-damaging uric acid, antioxidants, and immune system messengers that cause inflammation. So this was the theory, that the dehydration is making these people vulnerable to sugar, basically, and that the sugar is then killing off their kidneys. And they tested this hypothesis by subjecting mice to hours of high heat at a stretch, restricting their water intake in one group but not another, and then giving them high sugar drinks, high fructose drinks. And sure enough, this was published in Kidney International, the December edition. Kidney damage occurred only in normal mice on restricted water, providing compelling support for what some call now the heat plus hypothesis. In other words, what's killing these people is that they're working in the hot sun and sweating like crazy, but what's new about it is that instead of drinking water, they're drinking sugared sodas, particularly ones that have high levels of fructose. And that's taking out I'll quote. Johnson wonders whether people who are developing the disease might become dehydrated, then to quench their thirst, drink sodas that are high in fructose, compounding the problem. Rehydrating with soft drinks, he suggests, may toast the kidneys. So that's one theory. The other theory is, we've seen an increase in these high fructose soft drinks out in the fields. The other theory is a particular pesticide called glyphosate. You may have heard of it by its brand name. It's called Roundup. And a scientist by the name of Carlos Orantes, who's a nephrologist, that's a kidney doctor at the National Institutes of Health in San Salvador, he's skeptical of that. He says, we're not obsessed with pesticides, but we think they're at the center of the problem here. And they did a study in 2009, a demographic study, and he, well, here's, I'll read again from Science magazine. Orantes thinks the coastal regions may have the CKDU because the heat increases susceptibility to nephrotoxic, that is, kidney toxic, effects of the pesticides, the true cause. He also says that the pesticides interact with heavy metals like arsenic to poison the kidneys. And he points to research out of Sri Lanka suggesting that it's glyphosate in the pesticides. The glyphosate, Roundup, glyphosate in pesticides chelates arsenic, boosting its levels in the water and its potential to damage the kidney's delicate filtering machinery. And his team, quoting from Science, and his team has preliminary evidence that arsenic levels are higher in fields surrounding the cemetery than in the nearby village. The cemetery is this area where all these guys were buried out in the fields, you know, where they were working. So if that's the case, it could be that that arsenic is leaching back out of the bodies because they were poisoned by arsenic, because the arsenic was chelated out of the soil and out of the water by the glyphosate and then absorbed into their bodies, and, you know, high levels of arsenic. So basically they died of arsenic poisoning that took out their kidneys, and the result was, and it was from this pesticide. So these are the two big theories, but it's a huge debate going on right now among scientists. And obviously on one side you've got the soft drink manufacturers, and on the other side you've got actually it's an herbicide, glyphosate manufacturers, who are both saying, hey, wait a minute, let's get research under control. Okay, enough of my rants. I see my board is completely full. We will be picking up your calls for the next hour and a half.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
From New Mexico to New York to Maine to Washington to Texas, Colorado, California, Washington, you're up next on Anything Goes For. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Couple more things I want to share with you, but I will get to them as we continue through the next hour and a half of the day. Yesterday, well, actually, I'm going to start with one. Ronald sent me a note. I gave out some misinformation yesterday, and I always, you know, one of the cool things about doing this show is that so many people are listening or watching who are smarter than me or who know things that I don't know, and if I put my foot in it, they set me straight. And somebody called yesterday and said, is it possible that, you know, if you don't like your member of Congress, that they can be impeached? And I said, well, you know, there's an impeachment clause in the Constitution. You got to charge somebody in the House and prosecute them, you know, and convict them in the Senate. And I had completely forgotten about Article 1, Section 5, Clause 2, which says it's a lot simpler than that. Basically that each house, the House of Representatives and the Senate, each branch can kick out their own member. Here's what it says. Each house may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and with the concurrence of 2/3 expel a member. So it doesn't take the Senate to kick somebody out of the House, and it doesn't take the House to kick somebody out of the Senate. It just takes 2/3 of all the members agreeing to kick the person out. But again, the original question was a little more practical one, and I would say that that's equally practically difficult. The thing to do is to organize and get politically active. John in Albuquerque, listening on KABQ. Hey, John, what's up today?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about the fact that the Koch brothers and the libertarians and their institutes across the country are at heart John Birchers, and you should refer to them that way.
Well, the John Birch Society was, I don't know if it was founded by Daddy Koch, but he was a big funder and a big advocate of it back in the day. That would have meaning to people who are over 50, John, but I think most people under 50 don't even know what the John Birch Society is.
But you might want to talk about it and read their current diatribe on their website. It sounds just like libertarians and the Koch brothers.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the main raison d'être, or whatever, the reason for existence of the John Birch Society back in the day was A, to fight communism, and B, to fight integration. Although they did the second far more subtly by simply saying impeach Earl Warren because of that damn 1954 Brown versus Board of Education, ruling. I would argue that much of the modern infrastructure and political strategy of Americans for Prosperity and a lot of the other groups that the Koch brothers have funded and started and founded, for that matter, grew out of the successes and the failures, the mistakes that their father made with the John Birch Society. Good point. John, thank you for that. And you're right. People should go check out the John Birch Society's website so you know what's going on. They've been active in American politics, you know, for a long, long time. It used to be the Klan, you know, back in my grandfather's era, and then during my father's era was the John Birch Society, and in my era, when I was a kid, it was the John Birch Society, but now it's, you know, the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute and these groups. Tina in Jay, New York. Hey, Tina, what's up?
Hi, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How
about
you?
I know. It's a silly question.
Okay.
Forgive me.
It's fun to say.
The other night, one night this week on your evening program,
mm-hmm.
I don't remember her name. Danielle gave me a name, which I don't even remember that. Scotty, I think, was the first name. It was a female Republican rep person. I think you were the Lone Liberal Rumble. Maybe it was Tuesday. I don't remember.
Yeah, the Lone Liberal Rumble is on Wednesdays, and
Wednesday,
if she was
right.
with Rusty Humphreys, that was Scotty Nell Hughes.
Okay, well, this woman, you let her end the show. In fact, the last word of the show were you telling her you had the last word and her being very happy about it.
Yeah, that was Scott.
Previous to her last words, well, her comment that were the last words of the show, you were talking about numbers, about job numbers, Health Care Act sign-up numbers, et cetera. And she said that, well, with all these numbers, why is this country so miserable and in such a terrible hole? And then she proceeded to say, and these were the last words, according to you, of the show, the Republicans may not be in power, but their policies are. And I think that should be the Democratic campaign slogan.
Yeah.
We're so miserable.
This is the thing that...
In such a hole. If she's correct, and she believes herself, the Republicans may not be in power, but their policies are.
Yeah. Well, I can't speak to the veracity of your memory, but I trust it. You know, it's probably reasonable. Scotty, by the way, is just like Rusty. I mean, they're conservatives, but they're, you know, I know them both. They're very decent people, even though we strongly disagree on our opinions. And Rusty used to have a radio talk show, and we used to be on each other's show. Rusty went with me to Darfur and with Joe Madison and, you know, into the or to the South Sudan on the border with Darfur into this refugee hellhole at Gok Machar where Ellen Ratner, in fact, took us in. And so, I mean, it's important to think of these people as human beings. But I think that's a really important point, Tina. The and Scotty was his producer and has been friend of his for years and years. And in fact, Rusty and Scotty are independent people, very independent people. But Rusty's wife suddenly died a couple of years ago, too. I mean, he's had a really, really rough life. But. All that said, that's kind of the personal end of it. All that said, the point, if she was making that point, if Scotty was making that point, and I might have missed it because the last 15 or 20 seconds of a segment on television, I have a voice in my ear yelling, 20 seconds, 15 seconds, 5 seconds, wrap it up, you know, like that. And so I very often don't pay real careful attention to what's being said because my producer's screaming at me. But if that's the case, I have for a long time been suggesting that the messaging of the Democratic Party should be that ever since 1981, we have been living in the era of Reaganomics, that from 33 until 81, we lived in the era of FDR-nomics, and there isn't a good name for it. New Deal economics, it should be called. New, you know, and it needs to be branded. We had New Deal economics from 33 until 1981, and it built the most prosperous middle class in the history of the United States, the most functional democracy in the history of the United States. There were some rich people who got rich, but by and large, there were no eruptions of great wealth. CEOs were doing just fine, thank you very much, but only 30 times what the average worker made because the top tax rate was 91%. And then Reagan came along, and it genuinely was a revolution. And President Obama pointed this out a year or so ago. You know, he said Reagan was a genuine revolutionary, and he was. And ever since then, even through Democratic administrations, the Clinton administration and the Obama administration, we have continued to live in an era of Reaganomics, which is a fundamentally different economic system than the one and political system and trade system than the one that we had prior to 1981 during the New Deal era. And to your point, those, you know, that Reaganomics is the Republican policies. And I would submit to you that President Obama was elected by people who expected him to overthrow Reaganomics. They expected him to be a genuine revolutionary, and that expectation is still out there. People are still waiting for somebody to overthrow Reaganomics, and the president failed to do it for a variety of reasons, and I don't mean this as an attack on the president specifically, either personally or politically, but it didn't happen. And the country is pregnant with revolution, political revolution. And I believe that in the next 3 or 4 years, we're going to see that happen. In fact, that's the essence of my last book, The Crash of 2016. So we'll see where that goes. Tina, thank you for the call and the comment. Diana in Poland, Maine. Hey, Diana, what's up?
Hey, thanks for remembering, Tom. Your comment the other day from a woman who wanted an ID picture on her Social Security card so she could use it for voting.
Right, and well, it's an idea that's been proposed by Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter, too.
Well, was everybody aware that the Social Security Administration has warned us to never, ever use our Social Security cards for ID?
It used to be illegal up until the 1980s. Yeah, it was illegal for any corporation to require you to use your Social Security number for ID. All that changed during the Reagan administration.
And in fact, they tell you to memorize your number, put your card away somewhere, don't carry it with you.
Right.
So I'm thinking, if you're going to put a picture on a Social Security card and use it for ID, you might as well just plaster it all over the Internet and say, here I am, come
well,
take my identity.
See, here's the reality, Diana. Since Reagan made it so that it was no longer illegal for companies to use Social Security numbers for identifiers, you can now buy databases of people and their Social Security numbers. I mean, they're bought and sold on the open marketplace because now that's your ID number with your health insurance company or with your bank or with your Macy's account. I don't know if Macy's uses it, but you know what I mean. You know, retail. There's all kinds of people who are using Social Security numbers. So I don't think, you know, sadly, I mean, I lament this. I wish that we had a government ID number that was ours, that was unique, and that was secret. But you can find out anybody's Social Security number with very little effort and very little expense. So if we're going to do that, why not put a picture on the card? I mean, since it's already been compromised as a unique identifier. I'm still rolling that around in my brain. I get your point of view on it, Diana, and it's the one that I had most of my life. And I, you know, but I'm looking at the reality of the last 34 years, how things have changed. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Or maybe we should just roll back the Reagan policy of companies can use Social Security, can require you to give them your Social Security number and say no more of that. Welcome back. And Gary in Seattle, listening on KBCS. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. How you doing? Listen, I was listening to the Koch agenda there, and it occurred to me that, well, first of all, I wonder what their explanation for the benefits of this massive privatization might be. But then once that's done, the only limit on the power of someone to just buy everything up is the limit on their resources. But once they start buying stuff up, and like the roads, and they become the main rentier, and they're just, it's just like this, it's like one of those tipping points with the methane in the tundra, and it's going the other way into mass money. So at some point, they just own the entire country, and then are they not, you know, like Al Capone or the king or the, you know, it just seems to me that I don't understand what would limit them.
Well, the best metaphor is the game of Monopoly, which was invented by Mary, what's her name, back in the 1920s to explain how monopolies work. And, you know, at the end of a game of Monopoly, how does the game end? The end game, the end of the game is one person has everything and everybody else is wiped out.
So why is that good, though?
It's not good.
That's what they don't
explain. It's not good. But for some reason, the libertarians think that the free market will prevent that from happening in some magical fashion.
It could be a battle of the mainstream oligarchs or something, where they have all these wealthy people buying up stuff, trying to ward each other off or something like that. I mean, it's just idiotic. We have to get back to a more people-based democracy.
And I agree.
We'll be good.
I agree. Without regulation, capitalism becomes monopoly, and or at least oligopoly, and then when you add to that the toxic mixture of the Supreme Court saying that money is protected under the First Amendment as if it was speech, now that oligopoly moves into the political arena and takes over politicians, and that's the end of the game. I mean,
and
that's
you got
just
the Walmart there too, taking over towns and taking over legislatures. I mean, it's with all that money and that just having all the people just being drones in those stores. It's awful.
Yeah, there you go, Gary. Thanks for the call, Andrea in Palm Springs, California. Watching on Free Speech TV.
I couldn't agree more. I do feel if George Orwell were alive today, I mean, we have a whole generation that has been educated in double think even before
yes.
they knew the difference.
Yes.
And I do hope you are able to someday see Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life, because we would have a Pottersville writ large in America if the GOP and Koch brothers had their way. And this is what my comment is with regard to your question yesterday on what legislation the GOP ever did to benefit the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And the only answer I could conjure was when Reagan signed the Immigrant Amnesty Act.
Mm-hmm.
And he probably didn't promote it, but he did.
But here's how he did that, so that it would help the billionaires more than the average working person. First of all, it somewhat drove down labor prices over the short term, as that sort of thing always does. But over the long term, it's a good thing. So I'm not opposed to it. But the part of that bill that said that employers who hire people who are not citizens going forward from 1986, A, it was watered down tremendously, and B, Reagan made the conscious decision never to enforce it, and it functionally has not been enforced since. So all of the enforcement, all of the weight of law enforcement fell on the individual workers, but none of it on the employers. That's a problem. Andrea, thanks for calling. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Harbin here with you, and I could take one call while you're doing that, Shane. Should we do that? No. Okay. In just a second, we're going to have a report here from the Talk Radio News. But we had a bizarre situation here in our studio earlier the week where water was dripping out of our ceiling and one of the circuits fried on Shane's board. And so he's got to move Luke off one circuit and onto another. Luke?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Terrific. It's good to speak to you.
Good to speak with you, too, Luke. Remind me of your last name. I'm sorry. I don't have it.
It's Vargas,
Vargas,
which is very
right.
fitting because I'm calling from Medellin, Colombia, and with that name, I get confused with being a local quite often.
Oh, well, that can't hurt too much.
It doesn't hurt at all.
You know, unless you've managed to PO the local drug lords.
Not yet.
Yeah, I've been to Medellin. So what's going on in Colombia and what's going on in the world here today? We're talking with Luke Vargas of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. What's up?
Well, I'm here because the United Nations is holding the 7th session of the World Urban Forum here in Medellin. This is not a political meeting like those climate talks back in November. It's a chance for people to deliberate, to talk about best practices in administrating cities. And I think Medellin is a great place to hold this conference. Colombia as a whole really is undergoing a transformation, but no more so than in Medellin, where in 1991 there were 6,400 homicides in 1 year. That number is about a tenth of that now.
Yeah, I was there in 93.
Right. So you would have seen
it was
pretty
a damn
much,
scary place.
Yes, and it is. I would imagine light years different from that now. That number is about a tenth of back in 1991. And there's a real lesson here in urban planning that I think is important to communicate back to the U.S., which is that what Medellin has done is that they went into the worst neighborhoods in the city and they began giving them the best public services, linking them in with the rest of the city. They brought something called the Metro Cable, essentially ski lifts as public transit into those worst worst neighborhoods. You don't have to kick any people out of their homes to build this transit network. It's very quick to build and inefficient also. And what's happened as a result of this is that instead of isolating these people from the rest of the city, as I've seen in Buffalo and other places where bus routes are diverted to make it harder for people to go to the nice shopping malls.
I remember when we lived in Atlanta, there were parts of Atlanta that just absolutely refused to allow MARTA to come to their neighborhoods because, oh, my God, those people will come into our neighborhood.
Exactly right. It's been the opposite here. There's a great example that I witnessed of a ravine that separated two hills, essentially, and each hill and each slum on each hill had competing gangs. And what they did was build a pedestrian walkway across the two, and maybe there were some instances where it turned into an arena for some gun battle. But the result actually is that people could go from one side to the other. They could be with their family and friends and develop many more positive interactions because of that type of transit than they would be able to, than you'd be able to prevent essentially by keeping them separate. So a very good lesson here that I think could be well served to be implemented in the United States.
Wow, that's great. That's great. It's amazing that Columbia can afford to invest in transportation infrastructure, and the United States has not done that in any significant way since the Reagan administration.
There's public spending here, but let's compare it to some of the neighboring countries. We've got Brazil, where they've signed up for every mega event under the sun, holding the World Cup. I'm sure you've talked about the deaths of workers there and the incredible financial strain these mega events are having on the Brazilian economy, where they have to raise bus fares just to pay for these stadiums.
Right,
which are
people are pushing back on that.
Right,
quite
it's a very dubious long-term public benefit of any of those projects.
Yeah,
and here they
go
right.
Ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it was like, you know, the way that George W. Bush got rich, you know, with the Texas Rangers, you know, public pays for the stadium and suddenly his stock goes from being worth less than $1 million to being worth $17 million or something like that.
Right, precisely. And what Medellin has almost done, and people keep saying this, both locals and international observers are saying, Medellin almost pretended like it was going to be holding one of these mega events. It did all the infrastructure, the housing, the transit upgrades. And then the coverage is much better because now they're in a position to be able to hold a mega event. And the UN, in this case, comes knocking on the door. This is Medellin's Olympics. And the coverage they're getting is positive. It's everyone saying Medellin did it in the right order. They built the facilities for their own people, and then the rest of the world can come and look at it. It's not the other way around, and the city is not in a hole because of these investments. In fact, the Wall Street Journal named Medellin last year the world's most innovative city, so the plaudits are really coming in for Colombia, and I think a big time for this country.
Is Michelle Bachelet getting a lot of coverage down in South America? I mean, she's come out and she said, we're going to raise taxes on the rich, we're going to make public education available for everybody for free, and now we're going to put a cap or a cut of tax on the emission of carbon, you know, the first country in the Americas to do so.
I haven't actually heard much about that. I was attuned to that and hoping to hear about it. There haven't been too many real macro political statements or analysis being done here. A lot of times there are just so many events. I think there are 500 events here this week. Oftentimes they're very narrow in focus, so they're not a lot of
policy wonk stuff.
Yeah, I think that would be a fair assessment.
Yeah. What else are you learning there?
Well, something I think is very interesting is this real growing pushback to what this notion of the smart city. There's a Financial Times architecture critic here who said we've ditched, or we still have it in many places, the military-industrial complex, and what we've got instead is the political information complex, which is all these companies like GE or Siemens or Microsoft that come to these conferences and try to pitch to little countries all around the world, hey, buy our millions of dollars worth of product and your city will be on the grid, it'll be in the cloud, and all your services and the lives of people in your cities are going to improve. And I think there's a real worry about the commodification of the citizenry in cities, and that these companies are selling something that promises to be a panacea but is very far short of it. In many of these places where they're trying to get clients, there are no academies or no scholars or programmers who can crunch the data. So these cities think they've inherited a wealth of information they can use to make their cities better, but in fact they're getting something that they really don't know how to interact with, and instead maybe the model of just sort of, you know, following your nose around Medellin and seeing where the problems are and then addressing them is a much more simple and you know, less expensive way of tackling these urban problems that smart city concept, exceeds in many ways.
So how do we do that here in the United States, Luke?
That's you know, something for the American delegates here to try to understand. Sean Donovan of HUD is here leading the U.S. delegation. Perhaps he's thinking in some lessons, but he actually began his speech here on Monday by quoting the Obamacare numbers, and I detected a lot of people's eyes rolling into the back of their heads saying, oh, leave the politics at home. Come here and listen to what people have to say. So we'll see what the impact is for the U.S.
Yeah. Are they doing like solar rooftops like they're doing in Germany there?
Yes, and bamboo construction and earthen homes. There's the whole range.
Amazing. Okay, Luke Vargas from Columbia from the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Luke.
Take care.
Great talking with you. I much appreciate the report. We'll be back with more of your calls on Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Harpin Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday. And let's see. We've talked about Congress and senators can't be impeached. We've covered the Koch brothers' agenda. We've covered the Ryan budget. The Science News stuff. This is also from Science. Human activity may have triggered the fatal Italian earthquakes. These are the earthquakes where 27 people died. Ohio has now confirmed that fracking is causing earthquakes there. And while the Ohio is in certain parts of Ohio, they're saying, you know, hold off on the fracking companies. It turns out it's not so much the fracking that's causing the earthquakes. It's the reinjection underground of the wastewater from the fracking, because you reinject it into more stable, harder rock. And that causes the earthquakes. And so one company just got busted dumping their wastewater into a river. Ta-da! I mean, you know, what do you do with the wastewater, right? It's pretty amazing. Anyway. Thomas in Port Angeles, Washington, listening on KKBI. Hey, Thomas, what's up?
Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
Good. You're a Tea Party guy?
Say again?
You're a Tea Party guy?
Yeah.
Okay. What's up?
Well, the recent legislation on campaign contributions. I listened to some of the oral delivery on it. Got to see that on C-SPAN, and I didn't see, and I still haven't heard anything yet about the limitations or the barring of foreign governments putting money into our political process.
Oh, you never will.
If you'd heard anything.
You know, Sheldon Adelson, who was the big funder of, as I recall, both Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum, Sheldon Adelson makes most of his money in Macau, which is under the control of China.
But he's a U.S. citizen. He's employing some U.S. people, and he's got a staff here, right?
Right. So if a foreign government wants to inject, you know, billions of dollars into the American political system, all they have to do is find a U.S. citizen and run it through them, or create a U.S. corporation and run it through them.
Well, as far as the millionaires and the billionaires go, we've got a guy to look at up here. His name's Steyer.
He's a Democrat, Tom Steyer.
He's a hedge
fund guy, yeah.
And we're trying to find out, some people over in Whatcom County are trying to find out how much of that money came out of that guy and came up here. and went into the process for the things that are going on in Bellingham.
Sure.
And their recent elections.
Yeah, Tom Steyer is a left-wing billionaire who has committed, tens of millions of dollars to support candidates who are in favor of doing something about climate change or to defeat candidates who are denying the existence of climate change. He's kind of a one-issue guy, but that's his issue. This is, I don't think that that's any healthier for democracy than Shelley Adelson inviting people to come over and kiss his ring so that he can give them millions of dollars that he made in Hong Kong. You know, I think the whole thing, a pox on all their houses, not on their houses, frankly, because they're just doing what the law allows. A pox on the Roberts Court that made this all possible. Because there was a genuine, honest, good faith, bipartisan attempt to regulate this, and there's a long history of it. I mean, it goes back to the Church Commission in the mid 70s, but the most recent iteration of that was the McCain-Feingold Act. John McCain led the charge for this, for campaign finance reform. His state, Arizona, had publicly financed elections, which he was a big supporter of. And McCain-Feingold said, okay, that's it. You can't give more than $2,100 or $2,200 to any candidate. And, political action committees can't exist. And there's no, everything has to be transparent. There's no dark money and billionaires can't buy elections. And it was because he was sick and tired of dialing for dollars all day long. John McCain himself got badly burned, almost lost his job over the Keating 5 thing. He was one of the five senators who was taking money from Mr. Keating, who just died last week at the age of 90, the SNL baron who went to prison. And so McCain was like, enough of this. I don't want to have to talk to any more Keatings. I'm going to make this illegal. And they did. Him and Russ Feingold got together and they passed this law. And John Roberts and Anthony Scalia and Thomas and Kennedy and Alito said, nah, we're going to throw that out. Now, money's the same. Money's protected by the First Amendment. Didn't you know the founders thought the billionaires should be able to run our country? It's nuts.
Well, there's things that the Tea Party and the OWS folks had in common.
I agree.
One of the things I'm still harping on is Glass-Steagall. We've got to get that back into place.
Yep. Yep.
And, we have our cut mantra, and we've got our states' right issues mantra going on. But I remember when Cantwell got together with McCain, and they were talking about doing that early on, and I thought it was pretty brave that it wasn't Wasserman Schultz that said it. Who's the woman that's the political hopeful for presidency on the Democratic?
You're talking about Elizabeth Warren?
Elizabeth Warren, yeah. She actually brought that up a while back, and then I never heard anything more out of it.
Yeah.
But there was a pub that was out there in the late 80s, and it was called Sold Out. I wish I had the cover sheet here so I could give you the name of the authors and everything. But it was a blow-by-blow description of how over 4 or 5 years big money took Glass-Steagall out of the way.
Oh yeah. And the guy who was in charge of that was Phil Graham. And the big money, a lot of that big money was coming out of Enron and Ken Lay. And guess who was on the board of directors of Enron? Phil Graham's wife, Wendy.
You bet.
So and I mean, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to add two and two.
Yeah. Ted Cruz is okay. Goldman Sachs for his wife. Yeah.
There you go. There you go. And so is Hillary. Thomas, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to KKBI. It's nice to agree with a Tea Party guy. Charles in Hamilton, Texas. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I want to talk to you about this libertarian idea of having a minimum guaranteed income.
I did not know that was a libertarian idea. I thought that was a Occupy Wall Street idea.
Well, there's this libertarian economist named Charles Murray, came out with a book in 2012 called Coming Apart, where he lays out the libertarian argument for this.
Charles Murray, the guy who wrote The Bell Curve?
Charles Murray, yeah.
It's got to be a different Charles Murray.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway, Paul Solman interviewed him the other day on the PBS NewsHour as part of their ongoing series, Making Sense of Money.
Right.
They had him on.
So in a libertarian world, where would the minimum guaranteed income come from? Because libertarians don't want government handling anybody's money. How do you do that?
Well, he's saying that it's basically like a voucher program for welfare. But in other words, instead of the government giving you so much money for food or medical care or whatever, they just give you a lump sum of $12,000 at the beginning of each year.
Right.
And you spend it however you want.
Yeah, there is no doubt that you could do away with a lot of the welfare programs in the United States with a minimum basic income. And there's a fairly substantial movement for this in Europe. In fact, was it Switzerland or Sweden? One or the other.
Switzerland
just held a vote on it. Now, it went down to defeat, but they at least got it on the ballot. But they were setting it fairly high. They were setting it like $36,000 a year.
30,000 francs. I'm not sure what that is in America.
It's about $36,000.
Yeah. Anyway, his idea was $12,000 a year for everyone 21 and older.
Right. Right. And, this is, you know who originally proposed this, Charles? Thomas Paine in a pamphlet called Agrarian Justice.
I remember now. Yeah, I remember now.
It was Thomas Paine. He said whenever a young person is born, the government should create a trust fund in their name that will grow until their age of majority, until they're 21, and then they can start deriving money off, you know, taking the interest off of that, and they will have a guaranteed income for the rest of their life. That was proposed in, 1790, I don't know when it was, 1792 or thereabouts. Charles, thank you for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Let me add, I am a proponent of a national minimum income, as long as it's a reasonable one. I think, you know, $10,000 to $15,000 is a really good place to start. Welcome back, 15 minutes past the hour, and Michael watching Free Speech TV in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Well, I'll tell you what, it's all business. It's just business. Money is the cash flow. Money is the liquid assets. Banks, money, and government, and religion, it all works this way. Let me give you an example. It's like the Bloods and the Crips vying for power. Here's an example. When a ship from sea pulls in, it pulls in from the dockmaster pulls it in, and it sits in her berth from the water. Well, just like that, the ship has to deliver her product, and the dockmaster asks her for her certificate of manifest, which describes the products that she's carrying. Is it 2 cars, 300 cars? Are they red, blue? What are they? Well, just like that, we are delivered from the woman who we are delivered in birth from the doctor demands that we have a certificate of birth, which
right.
describes us.
Michael, are you going off again on this theory that because your name is in all caps, we're actually owned by some corporation that owns the United States of America?
No. I'm talking, you know, I've heard of that, but what I'm speaking of is the difference between Americans not realizing or understanding how this works. That is, it's all business. You know, a ship is like they make movies. You have the Starship Enterprise.
Right.
Well, look at it. You know, you got the shipment that when you want something mailed to you, it's a shipment, and it comes in, and it's an enterprise. An interesting thing is the captain come from the word capitalism, Captain Kirk, which, is, by the way, is Scottish. Kirk is Scottish. It's English. I mean, English is church. Kirk is Scottish for the word church. And it all comes from the ancient Phoenician language of Circe, who was a goddess who would hypnotize people, bring her into her house, and consume them. It's all business that we are a product of the corporation, which is when we die, we're called a corpse.
It works. Okay, and a corporation is called a corpus. What is the who owns the corporations? Is it lizard people or is it us?
Well, I that's a good question. You know, some people do believe in the reptilians, right?
Yeah.
I think that they are among that. It's got to be us. If the reptilians exist, they're here. They're operating behind the scenes.
Yeah. But if we own the corporations, then doesn't that kind of blow a hole in your theory that the corporations own everything?
Well, I think that it's not only a theory when we have an understanding, which is what we need to have.
Here's where I think we might agree on something, Michael. I would submit to you that there is a small group of people, and it's probably on the order of a couple hundred thousand, and there's a smaller circle within that that's probably a few tens of thousand, who basically own so much of the world that they have so much economic power that they basically have the political power to make the world happen. And those are the people who show up at Davos. Those are the people who are basically, you know, they're the central bankers. They're the ones who are basically making the economic and political decisions about the world and deciding how things are going to be. And, you know, I don't think you have to be an absolute crazy conspiracy theorist to point that out. In fact, Christopher Freeland essentially wrote a book about it called Plutocrats. You know, we live now in a plutocracy. Whether, you know, and many of them are using the corporate form to accomplish what they want. Others are using governmental forms. Michael, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. Van in Longmont, Colorado, listening on AM 760. You're saying people using, you got to get your Colorado license plates off your car if you leave the state?
Yeah, I mean, I've been pulled over 6 times in the last 2 years.
Really?
When I'm driving outside the state. And, you know, some of them, yeah, I probably deserve the ticket. I was doing 8, 9, 10 over. But, after that happened a couple of years ago, I started driving a lot more conservatively. And I've gotten pulled over doing 3 over, 4 over. And they, you know, they basically put you through the ringer. I've had my car searched twice. And
it's because they think you got pot on you? Is that the deal?
Yeah, and there's a guy up in Idaho, you know, got put through the ringer. He's actually suing the Idaho State Patrol. It's just there's articles in Westward Magazine about it. People are calling in saying, yeah, you know, I can't drive to Missouri, without getting pulled over. And frankly, what's going on in Colorado is awesome. I mean, you know, I think that having all of the money being spent on marijuana, staying inside the borders, tax money, I think the medical market did $329 million last year. And, you know, that money comes straight back into our economy. It's not getting shipped to California or Mexico or anywhere else.
Right.
It just goes right back into the economy. We've got 9,000 jobs in the state, in the marijuana industry.
Yeah, it's sort of what you're doing with marijuana in Colorado is what Portland does with craft brew and, you know, with microbreweries and beer. I mean, it's a good little business.
It's a good little business. I mean, they're talking we're going to be pushing $1 billion between the rec and the medical here.
Wow.
But, you know, the thing that's crazy is that, you know, Utah, Wyoming, Nebraska, Kansas, Texas, you know, the drug war is in full effect. And I think a lot of people, they forget about it. You know, you get here and it's almost becoming normalized here for it to be legal. And you go over the border and they're just chomping at the bit to put you through the ringer. And,
wow.
You know, people
if you want to drive somewhere, what you should do is go to a rental car place and get a car with out-of-state plates.
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely have thought about doing that. I mean, you know, I used to actually carry a little bit of weed with me, but I'm not even messing with it anymore.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Not a good idea, you know, if you're going
to
leave the state.
I used to be able to go mountain biking in Moab, Utah, and know that I could do that 150-mile stretch without any worry as long as I wasn't being stupid.
Yeah.
And now I think, you know, driving while Coloradan is a real crime. And,
driving,
you know,
while Coloradan.
You know, people are going to get pulled over and people need to be aware of it. I think, you know, I'm talking to a fellow that drove out here from Illinois, leaving Colorado, you know, I think people are just looking at it. They're looking at pot in every stop.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the new speeding, you know, it's the new opportunity to stop somebody. And in a lot of these states, they have laws where they can impound the car. They can sell the car. The police department gets to keep the money. I mean, that's even better than a $200 speeding ticket, right? This is better than speeding traps. If they find a seed or a bud, you know, in your car or underneath the back seat or something, you know, left over from a party 3 weeks ago. Bad news. Van, thanks for sharing that with us. Sorry to hear it. George in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, George, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Just a brief comment on Sheldon Adelson. In addition to making his money in Asia, his casinos also provide professional working girls for the guests. So a certain percentage of the money he puts into American politics comes out of the strenuous labors of young ladies who have to perform some rather outrageous acts.
I would be surprised if the casinos are officially doing that. I would guess that they're providing space, and then subcontractors come in. But I don't know. I mean, who am I to say? I have no idea.
It's only an aside because with the current dust up with Congressman Vance McAllister in the previous one.
Yeah. This is how absurd it gets. Mitt Romney, the Mormons, it's all family values, this and that and the other thing, salute the flag. Marriott is this big Mormon corporation, right? You stay in a Marriott hotel. I haven't done so recently, but it always used to be that you'd get a Book of a Mormon, in the bedstand next to you. And what is the thing that makes Marriott hotels profitable? The two things that make them profitable? Number one, porn. And number two, their alcohol concessions. If you took away their porn and their alcohol concessions, Marriott hotels, by and large, at various years over the last few years, I've seen this in several different reports, would have lost money. So, some of these hotel chains are among the largest porn distributors in the United States.
Yeah. The main thing I called about was this. You had former President Carter on about a week and a half ago as a guest, and he was discussing his book, and you brought up the subject with him that you often bring up with your audience, that the Republicans have not had a legitimately elected president since Eisenhower, and specifically referring to the decision of the Supreme Court to give the election to Bush in 2000. And President Carter said, well, I didn't agree with that, but we all have to obey the Supreme Court, even if we don't agree with it.
Right.
And constitutionally, that's not correct, because the Constitution gives the final authority to pass on the validity of electoral votes to the Congress.
You're right. Article 3, Section 2.
But it relies on one of the candidates
and
his allies making official challenges, and Al Gore wasn't up for the fight,
right,
which is all too common with Democrats. No,
yeah, and John Edwards was rip-roaring furious about it. I can tell you that. He was on our program a whole bunch of times prior to that, and we had some back-channel conversations with him and his people after that, and John Edwards was really PO'd at Al Gore for not going to the mat on that thing.
Well, whatever else you can say about John Edwards, he was a brass-knuckle, tough, hard-fighting lawyer who knew the law inside and out.
Yeah.
Al Gore wasn't. He was a journalist by training. And Jimmy Carter is a naval officer by training and a nuclear engineer. He's not a constitutional scholar either, even though he was a president.
Yeah, when Carter said, that the Supreme Court speaks, we've got to do what they say, I almost wanted to say, let me introduce you to Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln, who both said to the Supreme Court, take a hike, buddy. In Andrew Jackson's case, the Trail of Tears, and in Abraham Lincoln's Dred Scott. But George, excellent points. Thank you very much for the call. This is the area where Phyllis Schlafly and I agree, much to the chagrin of many of my listeners and viewers. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I don't think I've ever gotten so many PO'd comments from people as when I told Phyllis Schlafly on the air that I agreed with her. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. The Guardian has got a bit of a leak of the CIA torture document thing that Dianne Feinstein has said we should make public, but not until after. This is the one that documents all the CIA crimes of torture, not until after the CIA has an opportunity to redact the parts that they don't like. But pieces of it are being leaked, and it's ratcheting up the pressure. Most of this apparently happened between 2002 and 2006, and it simply reflected the sick and twisted mind of Dick Cheney in large part. This is according to Nancy Pelosi the other day on, I think it was Meet the Press or Face the Nation. She said, this is basically Dick Cheney's program. Well, enough. I'll leave it at that. I get worked up about this from time to time, and it's probably not a good thing for my blood pressure. Rick in Las Vegas. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
A quick question. The antitrust laws, they're still in place?
Yeah, the Sherman Act was passed in 1881 or 2 or whatever, and it's been, then the Clayton Act was passed during the Woodrow Wilson administration, and then there have been 3 or 4 other, modifications and adjustments to it. But, yes, absolutely. There are still antitrust laws.
What would it take to, would it take an act of Congress, or does the president have the authority, which one, that would, if they decided to start enforcing them again?
It's entirely up to the executive branch. Ronald Reagan in 1982 essentially and quite publicly stopped enforcing the Sherman Act. The last president to really aggressively do so was Nixon. He went after AT&T, and that took a decade. It was Jimmy Carter's administration when AT&T finally got broken up. And then Reagan came in, and he said, we're just not going to do that anymore. And what that led to was, if you're old enough to remember, the mergers and acquisitions mania, the M&A artists, these guys called themselves, Michael Milken. And they were all, you know, it was like, let's see how many companies we can jam together, how fast, and skim a piece off the top and lay off. You know, if you get five different companies and jam them all together, you can do away with four HR departments and four bookkeeping departments, and you can, you know, make them, quote, more efficient and lay off more and more people. And now we have basically every industry in America dominated by four or five companies and millions of unemployed Americans. So no president since Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and its subsequent acts in 82, no president has aggressively enforced it, not since then.
So we're only a signature away from eliminating corporate control of the network news.
That's correct.
And all the other problems.
That's correct. It's not so much a signature. It would take a president appointing an attorney general, because the Department of Justice is the primary oversight over this, although there are a bunch of smaller agencies also that have something to do with it, the SEC and others. But it would take a Bobby Kennedy kind of character. Not that this was Bobby Kennedy's issue, but, you know, with the passion that Bobby Kennedy went after organized crime and after racism in the United States, you'd have to have somebody with that kind of passion who is willing to go after corporate monopoly in the United States. And we haven't had that since the Teddy Roosevelt administration.
Well, thank you for the information.
You're welcome. It is something to bring up with the White House anytime you call the White House comment line. Susan in Wanna, Washington. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Hi, Tom, as usual. Just kind of throwing it out there, and maybe it's not correct, but what do you think the possibility that they're both sides are planning on the hurtfulness of what's currently coming down through the Congresses, the different houses, that by getting more people not having a home address, i.e. they become homeless or no longer living at that address, that then they won't be able to vote for the 2015 November ballot?
I can tell you that there are some states where, and some areas, and I believe that North Carolina is one of them, I've seen a couple of reports on this, where if you are homeless, it is damn near impossible to register to vote, and in some cases, impossible. So, yeah, the homeless are at the very bottom of the heap in the United States, and it's wrong. It's a moral crime. It should be an electoral crime. It's a terrible, terrible thing, because homeless people should have as much say in our democracy as anybody else. Thank you for the call, Susan. Michael in Newberry, South Carolina. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. I'm sorry it took me so long to get through. You were talking about the John Birch Society.
Yeah, last hour, yeah.
There is a book out that you must read.
Okay.
It's by Claire Connor, and that's C-L-A-I-R-E, Connor, C-O-N-N-E-R. Her family was a founding member, or were founding members, of the John Birch Society.
Hmm.
Growing up, she met Daddy Koch and the Koch brothers. Then she went off to college in Dallas.
Right.
She saw JFK 10 minutes before he was assassinated.
Right.
In her car, went home not listening to the radio. When she got home, she found out what had happened, called her dad in Chicago, and he said, if the police come to your door or the FBI, request a lawyer. Don't talk to anybody. Because she herself was a John Birch Society member.
Right. Well, the John, you know, let me just provide a little frame here for people who are listening who might be wondering what the connection is. And you may have an additional connection, but I mean, this is the obvious one that everybody pretty much knew at the time. was the John Birch Society had billboards around town that were anti-Kennedy, and they had a big ad in the newspaper the day that, I believe it was the Dallas Morning Herald, the day that JFK came, draped in black and, you know, basically calling the president a communist and then telling him he wasn't welcome in town.
Yeah. Yeah.
That doesn't mean that they killed him.
No, right, right, right. I'm not pushing it beyond that, but, yeah. You know, definitely a lady who knows everything about this.
What's the title of the book, Michael?
It's called Wrapped in the Flag. And okay. If I can read this one sentence off the back of the book.
Sure.
Wrapped in the Flag is a vital piece of the puzzle to understanding the madness that overcame America. Frank Schaffer. Or Schaefer.
Schaefer, yeah.
The author of Crazy for God.
Yeah. I'll have to check it out. Michael, thanks for the heads up on that.
Yeah, and her website is ClaireConnor.com.
Okay, with an E at the end of Claire and a spelled ErConnor.com, right?
Right.
Okay, got it. Michael, thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Whoops, I hit the wrong button there. Stephen in Rio and Rancho, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. What's up, Stephen?
Well, I was going to call just to say, just to tell the people that, you know, they don't have porn in hotels anymore because of the Wi-Fi thing. They charge you for that instead.
Oh, really?
So they get out of it.
It's been a lot of years since I was even tempted.
But really what I wanted to do was thank you for something that you've done that I'm sure some people aren't aware of. And that is, a while back, you used to make a big deal about Fridays, and you would say Shabbat Shalom and stuff.
Right.
And I sent you a couple of letters. I'm sure I'm not the only one who mentioned it to you, but there are those of us that don't have week. And for years and years, wished me, you know, have a nice weekend, and I always say, well, thank you, you too. When, in fact, if I didn't go to my job on the weekend, you know, the world would shut down if we didn't.
Well, I've had 3 weekends off in the last 2 years. I write books on weekends, so I put in, you know, typically a 12 or 14 hour weekend.
Right. And what I really wanted to say was I noticed, I totally appreciate it. You are a dear and wonderful man. And keep up the good work. And I signed the petition, and we've got moved to amend in Albuquerque now.
So, great.
Yeah,
great.
You're a wonderful guy, and I just wanted to thank you.
Well, you too, Stephen. I mean, you're part of the solution now. Thank you so much for your kind words. And that's interesting about they don't make their money on porn anymore. Now they make their money selling broadband. Because yeah, all the porn's moved to the internet. Duh! I should have figured that out. Jerry in Long Island, New York, listening on WBAI. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, obviously, as you know, as everyone knows, as it's been in the news, there's been this tragic, violent mass stabbing at a Pennsylvania school this week. And I'd like to discuss this and especially compare it to the Fort Hood shooting, because if you look at these two different horrific and violent incidents and you compare the very different outcomes, when a weapon other than a gun is used, this to me, this difference, disproves the NRA's rhetoric and their false assertions about guns and the weapons being used making no difference to someone who wants to kill people. Because obviously, as the very much alive victims of this mass stabbing in Pennsylvania clearly demonstrate, all weapons are not created equal. Some weapons are obviously more deadly than others. And therefore, they need to be banned, such as certain types of high-powered semi-automatic firearms, like the pistol used last week at Fort Hood, and also other types of high-powered firearms, such as the military-style AR-15 assault rifles that have been used in so many of these deadly shootings
yep.
from Colorado.
Totally agree with you, Jerry. I think, you know, the irony of the day that I believe it was the Newtown Massacre happened was there was this stabbing in China. This guy stabbed a bunch of kids and nobody died. And, you know, had he had Adam Lanza's gun, it would have been a whole different thing. But, yeah, I'm with you, Jerry. Totally with you. Not only that, the perpetrator was not shot either, and he's going
to
pay for his
crime. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So there wasn't, you know, a good guy with a gun to stop the bad guy with a knife, and the consequence of that is that we don't have a dead bad guy. We have a guy who can stand trial. Welcome back. James in Oak Harbor, Washington. Oh, it didn't take. There we go. James, you're on the air now. Hey, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Dr. Professor Hartman?
Thank you. What's on your mind?
Thank you for your service. You do a great service to our country. I love your show. I need my 4 hours of therapy every day.
Well, thank you.
I was born in 1964, the year of the dragon. When I was 9 years old, my mother was a school teacher. She gave me full use of her mimeograph machine.
Mm-hmm.
I think you know what one of those is.
Oh, I do. I remember them. I used to run a mimeograph machine in my elementary school. Yeah.
Cranking away on it, and yep. You get really high.
We had a hand crank one, and then we had a really high tech one that had an electric motor that spun it. It was almost like a printing press.
I had a hand crank one, and you got really high because there was naphtha or something.
Yeah.
Ether,
yeah.
I don't know.
There's some kind of chemical in that mimeo fluid, yep.
Yeah, but
probably an epidemic of liver cancer is a consequence of it now. Anyway.
That would be blamed on something else now.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's like two people, these in Naperville, Illinois, it's right next to Naperville. I think it's Elgin or something. I can't remember. But they had an old growth forest, like a 30-acre woods, and I love Winnie the Pooh. But some housing company wanted to cut down all the old growth oak trees. They've been there for hundreds of years. And I printed out all these memos and wrote it out on my bike when I was 9 years old and passed them out. And the place is still a national park. You can Google it, Eggerman Woods. It's spelled just like it's pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to thank you for your service. And
so did you help save an oak forest when you were 9? Is that the point?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's still a forest preserve.
That's pretty impressive.
So, it was 4 people with a mimeograph machine.
And you just printed up pamphlets about it and you got people active?
Yeah, I put them in mailboxes, which was highly illegal in those days. You can go to...
Yes, I remember. Yes, it's a federal offense to put things in mailboxes. I remember. It still is, technically, you know? It still is, technically.
Yeah.
It's not like anybody enforces that law. I don't think anybody ever did, really, seriously. But, well, good on you for being an old-time activist, James. And thank you for calling and sharing the story with us and for reminding me of the days of mimeo machines. You know, we've lost a lot of our memories and our heritage and our ancestry, and I'm not sure that has to do with heritage, but you know, you get the point. James, thanks a lot for the call. And nice memories of, you know, being in elementary school. Back when the teachers used to write the tests by hand and run them off on the mimeo machine. Now they're required to buy them from a testing company that Neil Bush owns so that the Bush family can make more millions of dollars, you know, because of No Child Left Behind. It's sorry to take James's sweet, inspiring story and turn it into some political trashing of the Bush family. Sorry. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farner and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the companies and all the great folks at the companies that syndicate our programs, Westwood One on commercial radio, Pacifica Radio, nationally and internationally on nonprofit radio, Sirius XM satellite radio all across the North American continent, cable radio network on cable systems all over the country, Free Speech TV that has us on Dish Network, DirecTV, and hundreds of cable providers around the nation. All the independent cable providers who carry our show from Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and others around the nation. To all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RT TV who work on The Big Picture. To the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn. To our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room. Hey! To Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service. To Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support. To our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. It is much appreciated. Let me remind you, by the way, to get over to pdamerica.org and sign that petition for Bernie Sanders to run for president. It's over at PD, as in Progressive Democrats, pdamerica.org. And sign the petition so that Bernie can, you know, to asking Bernie to run as a Democrat for president of the United States. We need his voice in the primary. Ray in Santee, California. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Hi, Tom. My question is, if large corporations had to pay for all their external costs, such as the use of the commons, damage they do to the environment, and also if they had to pay their workers a living wage and pay their fair share of corporate taxes, would they still make a fair profit?
Yeah, if they did all that, what you would basically have is the 1950s and the 1960s.
Well, if they could...
You know, let me just remind you, Ray, in the 1950s and the 1960s, the largest employer in the United States was General Motors. And in today's dollars, somebody who had been working at General Motors for 10 years made $50 an hour. That was the largest employer in the country, and that was their average pay, $50 an hour. Today, the largest employer in the nation is Walmart, and the average pay for their workers is in the neighborhood of $9 and change. That's how much things have changed as a consequence of companies not having to pay for their externalities. Walmart does not have to pay for the fact that their workers qualify for food stamps and welfare. They do get all kinds of, you know, free land and tax breaks and other things. They don't have to pay for the externalities of China pumping all that poison into the air and pollution and whatnot, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, everything that you just described, that's the difference between 1950 and, or let's say 1960 and today.
Well, I'm 78, and I grew up in the 50s. I'm well aware of that. But my question is, if they paid all those costs and they just made a small profit or broke even, wouldn't that prove that capitalism is just a scam where the corporations pass the external cost onto the taxpayers, but they get to keep all the profits?
No, I think what it would demonstrate is that regulated capitalism that is done... First of all, you have to disentangle capitalism and free enterprise. You know, running a business does not mean capitalism. Capitalism is when you invest money and then you make a living off the profits from that investment. So, you know, Mitt Romney is a capitalist, but the person who's the president of General Motors is not a capitalist. She's an executive and engaged in free enterprise. And there hasn't been a capitalist involved in General Motors since their original IPO years and years ago, other than arguably the federal government when we bailed them out. So, but what I would say is it demonstrates is that regulated business enterprise, let's just take the word capitalism out of the equation, regulated business enterprise, when it just like with regulated football games and baseball games, if you have reasonable rules for the game to be played by, the game is sustainable over a long period of time, and everybody can have a shot at it. Everybody can participate. Everybody can enjoy it, and it benefits society. On the other hand, when it's unregulated, the predators step in. They take advantage of the system to the extent that they can. They push out of the way the people who want to play by what used to be the rules, and they rewrite the rules, seize the political system that actually makes the rules, and that's where we're at now. We have highly dysfunctional capitalism, business, you know, fill in the blanks. It's highly dysfunctional. It's highly destructive. It's destructive to our planet. It's destructive to our middle class. It's destructive to our body politic. It's destructive to exploding cancer rates and autism rates and everything. It's just destructive to life, and we need to do something about that. And going back to a regulated form of capitalism, I think, would do it. Make sense, Ray?
Well, if we had nationalized the means of production, could not the government do the same things that corporations do, but do it better and cheaper?
No, not necessarily. When the lesson of the Soviet Union, and I was there when it was the Soviet Union, and I was in East Germany when it was East Germany, the lesson of state-run enterprise, I remember the old Trebbies, these god-awful cars, the three-cylinder, two-stroke engines that they made in East Germany that just poured, you know, smoke out the back end. The lesson of state-run industry is that it can be just as corrupt as privately owned industry. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And there is something to be said for competition. But you can't have competition between two baseball teams or between two football teams if they're not evenly matched. And you can't have competition in the business marketplace if you don't have somebody setting the rules of the game, defining how big the field is, enforcing the rules, and that means setting and enforcing the rules of capitalism. And that's what FDR did, and that's what Reagan started undoing, and it's what George W. Bush undid in a big way, along with Phil Gramm in 1999 and 2000 with the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. And all these things in aggregate have led us to the crash of 2016. Ray, thanks a lot for the call. You know, you're on to something, but let me. I hope I fine-tuned it in a way that makes a lot of sense. That said, it's Friday. Thanks so much for being with us this week. Next week, another great show. A whole lot of cool stuff planned for you, and we'll see what happens over the weekend. We will report on it on Monday. But don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. We really do have to participate. This is a really critical year. It's an election year. So please get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow. Or we'll see you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.